Welcome to the Stop Italian Sounding Podcast, uncovering authentic Italian food. I'm your host, Robert Campana, and join me as we delve into the rich heritage of genuine Italian food, exploring its legends, history, and traditions. Through important tips and insightful interviews with industry professionals, you'll gain a deeper understanding of authentic Italian food. Welcome back, everyone, to the Stop Italian Sounding Show, uncovering authentic Italian food. So today is going to be a good one because we have our first guest on the show. Not only is he a friend of mine, but he is extremely knowledgeable about wine. In fact, he's a master sommelier. Having traversed the global landscape of wine, both in terms of geography and profession, Marco Avigo has accumulated a wealth of experience. From Jakarta to Texas, he's delved into various facets of the industry, graduating as the youngest master sommelier from the Italian Sommelier Association of Milan in 1986, marked a significant milestone. Ownership and operation of Ristorante Gallo d'Oro in Moniga, Lake Garda during the 90s earned him acclaim as one of the best restaurants in Northern Italy for five consecutive years. Some of the following ventures included roles at Saber in Lugano, Switzerland, Viva Vino Import Company, where he spearheaded marketing efforts and expanded into new markets, subsequent positions at Penne Restaurant and Embassy Suites Hotel showcased his expertise in hospitality management. In 2010, he established Alto Palato, a catering service, and earned certifications as a wine location specialist in 2011. Additionally, he founded Marco Avigo Tours in 2013, offering immersive tours in Italy's culinary and wine delights. Marco, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk about something that you're so passionate about, which is wine. So Marco, I want to start with the first question. What's your story? How did you get to become a master sommelier? What led you through this path and why such a passion for wine?
Oh, thank you, first of all, for inviting me on this pleasant conversation. You know, it's always a pleasure for me to talk about wine anytime, anywhere. Oh, my experience started many years ago when I was a teenager. My father, I grew up in a restaurant business in my father's restaurant, and my father was one of the 15 people that created the Italian Sommelier Association in 1965. So I started to go around wineries with him in my teenager age. And I slowly fell in love with the world of wine without even realizing. And after, when I opened my first restaurant in Italy, it became some kind of necessity to become a master sommelier like my father. Plus, it was a little, family competition in size.
Of course. That always helps.
And the adventure is still on. The world of wine, it's an amazing world because you never stop to learn. You continue to find new wines, new producer, new reality, new technology. So it's really a fascinating area.
Great. And of course, like you said, the competition at home always helps, of course. So you're a master sommelier. What is the difference between a master sommelier and just a sommelier? I say just a sommelier.
Yes. Well, let me explain to you a little bit. First of all, a lot of people don't understand or don't know that you have several schools around the world on becoming sommelier. When I present myself a master sommelier, they automatically try to connect me to the American school way the master sommelier are coming out. And I'm not. This is why I say to myself always, I am an Italian master sommelier, not because I'm also Italian, but because I was graduated at the Italian Sommelier Association in Italy. And every association is a little different from another. The typicality, the particularity of the Italian Sommelier Association is that it's the only school in the world that it's focused on becoming an expert on pairing food and wine. So it's not just about learning about wine by itself, but it's also the pairing that is important. And this is what actually the the figure of a sommelier was created in the 60s, the job that we supposed to do inside the restaurants, it's or even through the technology that we're using today, it's to help the people to pick up the right wine for the right food, and vice versa. And for what?
So pairing food and wine, of course, they go together.
That is our priority.
Okay.
And going in detail of Italian, our work, the Italian sommelier school is that you sign up to become a sommelier. You have different levels. You can become a regular sommelier after you sign up and you pass the first year, or you go through the whole 9 yard. In this case, are 3 years of school, and you have to pass a test every year to reach the next level. And when you finish the whole 3 years, you have a final exam on internal commissions, where you have this special test. It's a writing, it's interrogation, it's a service. And if you pass, you become master sommelier.
You become a master sommelier. I'm assuming that test also includes some taste testing as well.
Oh yes, and a different school. You know, think about that. If you want to compare, the Italian Sommelier Association was created in 1965. The French Association was created in 1969. The American Sommelier Association was created in 1998.
Okay. So of the three, the Italian ones.
1986. So,
I'm sorry. What was the last one?
I became master sommelier in 1986.
So some time ago.
Some times ago, when here in America talking about sommelier at the time, probably a lot of people didn't even know what doesn't mean
what it was exactly. Well, some years back, yes. I didn't even know what it was, of course. And once you know you get in the industry, you totally understand. But you mentioned in order to go through the school, you mentioned that there are kind of two paths you could take. Are there any prerequisite things that you have to have completed to join the school to become a sommelier? Or
the school is open to everybody.
Okay.
Like in every sommelier association, everybody can sign up. Now, and after, based on what you're looking for, you have to, you know, push yourself and start to study.
Of course.
And do that. Or just join the sommelier association. It's a lot of people just stop at the first year. But you want to just be part of this world, receive information. Of course, you have a magazine, you have a newsletter where they keep you updated on what's going on the wine market.
Of course, of course. And that also perfectly leads me into my next question. In terms of the wine market and the wine industry, according to your professional point of view, what is the current status of Italian wine here in the United States? Is it healthy? Is it growing? I know.
It's good. It's good. The number two as a country, the first one is France. France is importing America around 25% of the wine consumed in America.
Oh, wow.
Italy is second with the 22%.
Oh, so we're right there.
More or less. So, and we are lucky. We're lucky. American people, thanks God, love everything that comes from Italy.
Of course.
And so it's an easy job in that way.
Exactly.
When you talk about wine.
Exactly, exactly. And what, according to you, is the most loved Italian wine in your experience? In your experience in talking about wine, serving wine, pairing wine with dishes, what seems to be in the American brain the go-to Italian wine?
But they all know the important wines. From Italy, more or less, you know, region like Tuscany, of course, Piedmont, big names. What is a pleasant and also fascinating working here is that American people are really eager to learn. They are looking for experience, they are looking for suggestion. Unfortunately, on the other side, you also have a lot of people that talk about wine, but they don't really know what we're talking about. So this doesn't help. And you realize that when you talk to people about wine and they come up with some information that they receive from somebody else that are not really helpful. The other thing that help the Italian market is that a lot of our wines are not really complicated to drink. You know, wine in Italy, it's part of our culture. It's part of our tradition. You have a bottle of wine on almost every Italian family on a table during lunch or dinner. And it grew up with us. So meaning that you don't drink just big, heavy wine. You drink everyday wines, well-made, well-prepared, easy to understand, not too expensive. And when you have the opportunity to explain this kind of reality, of course, you create a lot of curiosity.
Of course, of course. And I could speak, at least from my Italian-American point of view, that there is a big level of curiosity, absolutely. You got me thinking, you mentioned here in the United States, people typically recognize the major Italian wines. We talk about Chianti, but I also think of like a Lambrusco as well. So could you just explain a little bit about Lambrusco? I don't know if it was back in the 80s or when Lambrusco actually entered the U.S. market. Lambrusco kind of has earned a tarnished name here in the U.S. when in reality Lambrusco is a good quality wine in Italy. So why is Lambrusco kind of, I don't want to say looked down upon here in the United States, but it kind of is in a way. Why?
Unfortunately, even in Italy, you have people try to take advantage of what's going on the moment. And this happened with, I tell you another wine right now that is really famous, with Prosecco. You know, you start to realize that now everybody have a Prosecco and everybody are producing Prosecco. Unfortunately, the reality is it's different. And you have a lot of bottles that are on the market that are not really interesting or has almost nothing to do with the typicality of a Prosecco. Going back to Lambrusco, it's an easy wine to copy. Because the typicality of a Lambrusco, because it's a sparkling wine, you know, you are able to obtain this bubbling sensation in any wine if you want, but especially in this red wine called Lambrusco, because what I do, I don't let all the sugar ferment in the wine. This means that the wine will not be too alcoholic. You know, when you cut the percentage of sugar from becoming alcohol, you cut the percentage of the alcohol by itself in the wine. So, in fact, the alcohol percentage in a bottle of Lambrusco, it's usually between 9 and 10% compared to a regular red that is between 12 and 12.5. Because the 2% of alcohol that I let into the must as a sugar during the fermentation process, it created this fermentation sensation that is really pleasant to drink when you open this kind of bottle. The problem is that the characteristic of this wine by itself, it's a light, easy wine. When you have a light, easy wine, it's also easy to, I want to say, manipulate the product, you know. The bubbling and this little touch of sweetness that make the wine really easy to drink, it's something that you can put together if you don't have Lambrusco grapes. And this is what's happened with Lambrusco. You know, it was an inexpensive product, easy to make, and suddenly you start to have a big winery in Italy and one of the biggest names that ruined Lambrusco was called Giacobazzi, the guy that arrived at one point to create Lambrusco in an aluminum can, like wow. Coca-Cola. Talking about late 80s, beginning of the 90s. And that slowly destroyed the image of Lambrusco. As today, when you talk about Lambrusco, a lot of people say, yeah, it's definitely not a wine that I want to taste. And it's a shame because...
it is a shame.
Like you say, it's a really interesting wine. And also, you have several different domination of this wine in Emilia-Romagna. And every Lambrusco is different from another one.
It is. It is. And
importantly, to recreate this kind of reality and positive reality on the American market, it's really hard because the damage was created and
now we're on damage control.
To try, you know, to try to recreate, you know, the regular image. But this is the job that people like me are doing constantly to try to insist on representing this kind of product on a different way. And when you're able to do it, people realize the difference and they start to reappreciate the wine.
I suggest we organize a Lambrusco tasting because I've tasted some really good Lambrusco wines in Italy absolutely. And some that I could find even here in the United States. And one in particular that stands out is Lambrusco di Sorbara, which is the red sparkling dry wine. Everybody thinks...
You have Grasparossa, you have different Lambrusco, and each one has a typicality that's different one from another one. So definitely.
Exactly. So yeah, I just wanted to kind of clear the air with Lambrusco because I don't like that it gets a bad rep here in the United States. It's a good wine. If you could find the good quality ones, like you said, there are different, different varieties of Lambrusco. Are there specific, trends that you notice going on here in the United States when it comes to wine?
No. I want to say that it's growing, the selection of different labels, it's growing, definitely. As I said, the Americans are drinking more and more wine year after year, so they're really interested in this kind of market. What one of the things that... we are spending time on teaching is that what a lot of people don't know is that for what is connected to Italian wines, American people don't know how to read the label. Or better, American people don't know how to read the bottles because for the American law, or the, I don't know how this happened, but the information connected to the wine that you are buying as a wine produced in Italy, are not in the front label, are in the back label. So to find out if a wine is an IGT wine, is a DOC wine, the region, the alcohol, all that information are in the back label, not in the front. And not know that, you know? So you look at a fancy label, in the packaging, it's presented very well, and you buy it. And unfortunately, you have... Fortunately, you have a really good wines produced in Italy on this market, but also you have a lot of wines that are not really well represented.
Exactly.
as Italian country on this market.
So if I'm just a normal consumer and I want a decent bottle of wine, what is the quickest and easiest thing to look for on the bottle?
But definitely you want to know if a wine is classified. And we have three... sigla that help the buyer to find out. You know, it's an IGT wine, it's a geographic wine, it's a DOC wine, or the top level is a DOCG wine. So all these classification are selecting the quality of a product. So higher is the classification, smaller is the production of this particular wine. This is why it's more expensive, and this is why it should taste better. And this information, a lot of times, are not in the front label, are in the back label. As I say, you have a lot of fantasy label wine produced in Italy, present on the market, that capture the attention of the buyer because they're fancy, they're funny, they look good. But a lot of times are wine that are created just for the American market.
Of course.
you know, the touch easy to drink, a touch of sweetness level a little too high, and but not really represent the typicality of Italian wines.
Of course, of course. So the easiest thing, according to you, is to look for the classifications, and a lot of times these classifications are in the back of the bottle. And just so for our listeners to properly understand, the three classifications that you mentioned are the IGT, the DOC, and the DOCG, in that specific order, DOCG being the highest classification. What is the difference between a DOC wine and a DOCG wine?
As I said, it's the regulation that the government put on the table to the producer, say, if you want to produce this kind of wines, you have to follow these rules. And to be able to call that wine with that classification, you need to have a sticker that the Italian government will release to you once it controls that what you did was made correctly. So it's not just connected to the name by itself. You have to put this sticker, this kind of
labeling.
Labeling and the government, it's selling that to you, so you cannot buy on your own.
So it's extremely strict.
Yes, and to be able to obtain that, the government will control your winery to make sure that you do what you're supposed to do.
The government would check.
Keep to give you an example in a really easy way. I'm producing a Pinot Grigio in Pennsylvania. That is called IGT because the quantity is huge. I can use Pinot Grigio from all around Pennsylvania. If I want to do a DOC, to obtain a Pinot Grigio with a DOC has to be produced only in Philadelphia. So, of course, the quantity now is completely reduced. The alcohol level is a little different. The quantity of grapes that you are able to grow on the vine has to be also reduced. To have the DOCG Pinot Grigio, it's a Pinot Grigio that will be produced only in South Philadelphia. So you have an extra reduction of the selection of vine, an extra reduction of the quantity of the grapes that you are able to grow in the kind of vine, and so. So it's based on a different regulation that you have to follow to be able to obtain the kind of wine.
The grape yield is much smaller when it comes to DOCG, and I know the analogy you were using in Pennsylvania made sense. Pennsylvania, then Philadelphia, then a small area of Philadelphia, and of course to relate it to Italy, we talk about a region and then a smaller area of that region, and then maybe only a city, let's just not even a city, but a smaller geographical region. And speaking of Italian regions, is there, in your opinion, an Italian region that produces wine that is underrated and deserves more recognition here in the United States? What would that be in your opinion?
Not underrated, unknown. You know, Italy produces wines in every region. We're the number one country for quantity of wine produced in the world. We're talking about between 50 and 60 billion hectoliter or liter of wine every year, and with a huge selection of indigenous varietal of grapes that no one has around the world. We're talking about 600 indigenous varietal that grow in Italy. And every varietal gives you a particularity that is completely different one from another one. And you find wine everywhere, from the region attached to the Alps, to the region in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, like Sicilia and Sardinia. Think about that. In the ancient time, Italy was called Enotria, the land of the wine, because we had everywhere. And a lot of people are not familiar with the fact that Italy has 20 regions, and everybody knows Tuscany, everybody knows Piedmont, talking about wine. Campania for the Amalfi Coast, it's more connected to what the producer or the consortium spend as advertisement on this country that the product by itself. You have a lot of regions that are small, they don't have a lot of potential financially, but that doesn't mean they don't do really good wine.
Of course.
Actually, sometimes it's the opposite.
Of course. I know for me personally, Sicilian wine is kind of, I'm not underrated, but unknown is a better word. A lot of Sicilian wine, and I think that they produce very high quality wines. I mean, one that I think specifically, you know, Nero d'Avola, but also Zibibbo, just to name two.
Oh yeah, no. All the South Italy area had a huge transformation in the last 30 years. From region that used to produce a lot based on the quantity, but really a low level of quality, the new generation of producer turned the reality upside down. So now they reduce drastically the quantity of the wine that they produce. And that, of course, increases the level of the quality of the wine that they produce.
Another region I could think of is my region, Molise, which happens to be the unknown region of Italy, but we do produce wine as well. And one thing I'm thinking of specifically that actually a follower sent me on Instagram was a video of wine production that is aged underwater in the Mediterranean. Have you heard of that technique? Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't know much about that at all.
What is fascinating for people like me that spend basically almost 50 years in the world of wine is, I am a lucky person because I had the opportunity through my father learn a lot of learn the technique that we were using today, at that time meet old producer, young producer, old winemaker, new winemaker. And what is fascinating for me today is to see that we are going back to what we used to do and as a technique on making wine. Like I said, think about that in the 80s, when the new generation of winemaker decide to change, start to use this new technique, start to use the oaky sensation in the wine through the barrique barrel. They throw away all the experience, the technique that the father and grandfather were using to make wine. Now the new generation is going back to pick up the stuff that the generation before threw away and start. So they're using. Now we're using glass, we're using cement, we're using terracotta, all containers that 30 years ago were not good anymore. and now they are. Now, you know, we have a biodynamic producer. You know, we grew up with grandfather looking the moon and follow the tide of the sea to do the treatment on the vine. And at that time was based on the experience. Today, now we call these producer biodynamic producer. They are just.
They have these fancy terms.
Hanno scoperto l'acqua calda.
Exactly. They discovered hot water.
Now it's more advanced. Yes, but you know, age. I don't know if you heard, but a few years ago, they found a ship on the bottom of the North Sea. That was sunk around, I think, the late 18th century. And the ship was bringing 200 cases of champagne crystal to the Tsar in Russia. They opened the wine, and the wine was absolutely still fantastic after almost 200 years.
Wow, that's crazy. So this is a technique.
The pressure of the water, the cold of the water, basically, I don't say it freezes the wine, but it slows down drastically the aging process. So, of course, aging wine under the water, it's one of the ancient technique that people were used to.
See, I didn't know that that was an ancient technique. That's to me, that's new. But like you said before, they're taking new ideas and making them new, or sorry, taking older ideas and rediscovering them and making them new, or I should say, exactly. Making them better.
Oh my God, look what this guy did. Yes,
exactly. And it looks cool to watch, you know, it really does. Very interesting. So, Marco, I know that you run tours, in Italy. I'm just very interested and curious about your food and wine tours, because you're very knowledgeable, of course, about wine, about pairing wine to the food. What is involved in your tours?
But my tour, I started to create this tour based on the request of the people that was coming to my wine classes. One day, talking to a table, I say, why we don't go to Italy and try to taste this there? And these are how I start to create this wine tour. And my tour are definitely a little different from a regular wine tour. First of all, the dimension of a group, it's really small. When you go to visit a restaurant or a winery and it's just 7 or 8 people, the time, the attention, the treatment that you receive is completely different from going to visit these places with a group of 30 people. Also, the other typicality is that through a person that is with you constantly through the tour, that knows food and wine, you are able to absorb a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, and experiencing in the right way the food and the wine experience in Italy.
On a more personal level. Again,
you have a lot of people that really talk, but they don't really know what they're talking about. And when you are in Italy with an Italian guy that is explained to you from the vine to the bottle, what's happened to the product, and you are able to enjoy that product with the right meal in a really nice restaurant, of course, the experience is completely different. And
you used the correct word. You said the word experience, which is what a lot of people like to feel when they're going on these types of tours. What is the quote unquote official way to taste wine? I mean, people just drink it, but what are the steps to properly taste a wine?
You have 3 steps really easy that you should follow every time you open a bottle of wine. First, you check the color, the transparency of the wine, and after you smell the wine, and after you taste it. What people start to understand is that if in the first 2 steps something is not right, you should not even reach the 3rd step. Means that if a wine is not transparent, it's a defective wine.
So
a product will not be good. If a wine smells not intense and pleasant, but a funny smell or an unpleasant smell, means the wine will not be good. So don't even bother to reach the final tasting, just push the bottle away and open another. Steps is helping you to understand if you are going in the right direction or not.
Okay, that's good insight. So the first 2 steps are pointing you in the right direction as to if you should, experience step 3.
Exactly. Sometimes you are willing to save a wine because it's not as supposed to be, but at the end it tastes good. No, it doesn't. If a wine doesn't pass the first 2 steps, means that the final product will not reflect the typicality of a wine. So you're drinking something that may be still drinkable, but will not give you the sensation that are really connected to that particular wine.
Understood. That's really good information to know. Has there ever been a case in which you open a bottle of wine and you're trying to pair it with dishes and that wine didn't seem like it would pair well with the dishes, or was a defective wine. What did you do in that situation?
Oh, you just move on. You move on. Don't, you know, when the wine is bad, it's bad. Don't waste time, as I said. Plus, you have some option. You know, it's not that you are limited to 3 bottles of wine. So today, especially on this market, American market, you have the production of all around the world available. So definitely, it's fun to go to a liquor store and buy a bottle of wine if you know what you're looking for.
Exactly. I equally find it as fun because, you know, there are specific wines that I personally like, so I know what to get. I'm in and I'm out. But I do like to also look at the labeling and read things, as you were saying earlier today. Anyway, I have a few questions that came in from my followers that are, I deem as the fun questions or the interesting questions, if you will, that I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind. And one of the questions that came in was, if you were to choose only one wine to drink for the rest of your life, one Italian wine, what would that be? What is, I guess, your favorite Italian wine? I know that's difficult to ask to a master sommelier. It's like asking to choose your child.
You're punishing me.
I'm sorry.
On going in that direction. But if I have to pick up a wine that will help me more or less to pair a lot of food, I will go with probably a rosé wine. In the area where I come from, on the Lake of Garda, they produce one of the most interesting rosé made in Italy. And what a lot of people don't know is that rosé, it's a really important and difficult wine to make. Rosé wine comes from red grapes. The rosé that I'm talking about is produced with 4 different grapes and are all 4 local important grapes. Why rosé? Because the rosé, when it's well made, is able to give you the freshness and a pleasant aroma that you usually find in a white, but as also the structure of the body of a red. Means that it's a wine that you can pair with a lot of food. Food that usually you will pair with white, and food that usually you will pair with red. So if I had to pick up a wine that would help me to eat whatever I want, more or less, a rosé definitely should be the choice.
Okay, a rosé. And just out of curiosity, what is the name of that wine that comes from?
The rosé produced from the Lake of Garda is called Chiaretto. And unfortunately, it's not so easy to find here in America. But you can drink a lot of this wine when you come with my tour.
Okay, absolutely. When we come on the tour, we're gonna drink a lot of it. I have no problem with that. I remember when I was at one of the wine events, the wine dinners that you were speaking at. One of the things that stood out to me that was quite interesting was you should start with white bubbly wine and then work your way up to the heavier red bodied wines. Is that the best order? Like when you have an appetizer, for example, you typically start with a lighter wine and then you work your way up, correct?
Yes, exactly. Always. Even in a dinner at home, if you have a white and a red, usually you drink the white first and the red after. Just because heavier it's the wine that you're drinking, more long your palate and your mouth will need to clean up. So if you're able to go through these steps, you are able to taste 2 or 3 wines through a wine dinner or through a regular dinner. If you drink an heavy red as a start, and after you have a couple of whites that you want to taste, you will not really able to enjoy it because your palate is still covered with the powerful sensation that you receive from the big red, you know. So it's like with the food, you know. You don't eat a stew before a light appetizer, you know. You eat a light appetizer first, and after you enjoy a beef stew at the end of a dinner.
Right, right. Understood. Has ever been an unexpected pairing of a wine that most people don't think you would pair this wine with this dish?
As I said, The world of food and wine, it's an amazing world because you don't need to learn the 50 rules to pair food and wine. It's a constant, continuous experience that you do. You do pairing with wine that didn't supposed to work originally, but because the wine maker changes some way on to do the particular wine. So I always say that people, the best way to learn is to try. To try, you know, the palate it will tell you if the pairing was good or was wrong. Years ago, when I was working with a slow food group in Philadelphia, I created a dinner pairing with dessert wine on a regular dinner. And it was tough to find the right wines. I worked with a chef for 2 weeks to be able to create the pairing. I had to go to New York to find a couple of wines that I wasn't able to find in the area in Philadelphia. But at the end, the experience was really interesting and unusual. You know, you never think that you are able to drink a dessert, a sweet wine with a salty meal. But if the
characteristics.
The characteristic of the food are combined with the characteristic of the wine, you can do it.
Of course.
As I say, the best way is to try.
Absolutely.
Once you try, you will realize that, okay, this is definitely not working. You know, the wrong wine can make a wonderful meal taste really bad and vice versa.
That's good. That's good.
But this is why, you know, we spend... In Italian Sommelier Association, we spend 1 year just working on the pairing, and it's boring. And it's boring because when you talk about that, people think that, oh, wow, you're having dinner. No, you're not having dinner. You taste bread with wines. So you taste the single ingredients. You taste oil. You taste butter. And you continue to pair with different wines to be able to understand what kind of typicality or characteristic you need in a wine to be able to match the food. But once you are able to have a kind of information, it will become a lot easier for you to go to a store and pick up the wine for the dinner that you are preparing because you know what are you looking for.
That's great advice that you give is to learn by doing, by trying. Absolutely. Marco, I'm going to ask you one more question because I don't want to, we've had a very nice conversation. I want to keep you too long. I know your time's very valuable. So my last question is this, what advice would you give to somebody who is just starting their journey towards the world of wine? I know you kind of just talked about just try, but one thing in particular.
Oh, actually, I can give you two that can be definitely helpful for the people. The first one is start to drink light and easy wines. Don't try to drink an Amarone or a Cab from Napa as a first wine. As approach to the wine, because it will be probably not pleasant. So start with something light, something fruity, something also well made, and from there you slowly go into you know the world of the wine. But definitely something light. The second suggestion is the best way to also taste wine is go to a wine tasting. A wine tasting, you have opportunity to taste several wines without spending a fortune on your own. And when you go to a wine tasting, what you should do is take your glass, walk away from everybody, taste the wine by yourself. Because at the end, we're talking about something that has to give us pleasure. So you don't need me to tell you what you have to taste. You need to do this on your own. If the wine will give you sensation that you like, sensation that make you really satisfied with a product, you can go back to the table and ask more information about the wine by itself. But what is important, it's you. You, when you taste something, and this happened with everything, when you taste it, you do something that you really like, that experience will remain with you. If I'm telling you what you should experience, that information will disappear really soon once you leave.
And that's great advice. Take the bottle of wine, walk away from the table and taste that wine so you're not influenced by the other decisions. So nobody's telling you what you should like because you like what you like, of course. And that's really good advice. I like that. Anyway, Marco, I thought this was a great conversation. We talked about wine. We talked a lot about stuff. Real quick, what is the easiest way for people to get in contact with you if they were to be interested in one of your tours?
My email is info@marcoavigotours.com.
Okay.
And you can reach me through the email with any question you have, not just about tour, if you're looking for some wine suggestion, absolutely. I have a lot of friends and people that know me. Sometimes we are in a liquor store. I take a picture of a label, they send it to me. So they want to so I can definitely help you in that kind of area.
Great. That's awesome. And I'll also put that email in the show notes as well so people could access that. Great. Well, I thank you very much for your time. It was a fantastic conversation. I hope to have this conversation again. So thank you very much. Grazie mille, Marco.
Oh, if you talk about wine, I'm always available.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Roberto. Ciao. Have a nice day.
Thank you for joining me on this journey through the stories of authentic Italian cuisine. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for more insights and interviews. Also, feel free to reach out with your thoughts or questions on our social media channels @StopItalianSounding. Or on our website, stopitasounding.com. Grazie a tutti e alla prossima.